This episode of Find a Way is brought to you by Crooked Path Forge, where you can use Find a Way's special promo code FINDAHAMMER to get a 10% discount on any purchase at crookedpathforge.org. Founded by blacksmith, author, and teacher Jordan Borstelman, Crooked Path Forge is one of the many gems that makes Gainesville a treasure. Not only does Jordan and his team forge pristine blades, axes, various metalworks, and custom builds, but Crooked Path Forge also offers incredible workshops and classes for people like you and me who might want to take a swing at this ancient art form. These classes are the perfect gifts for your friends, family members, or just to yourself. You don't have to wait for a special holiday, although keep in mind the holiday season is upon us. But these classes are worth experiencing just for the chance to expand your horizons. I've attended two of them before I even conceived of this podcast. One, I got to make a 6-inch blade with my friend Ian, which I still use and brag about. And another, I got to make a hatchet with my brother-in-law, David. Both end products exceeded our greatest expectations, both in appearance and utility, all due to Jordan's tutelage. Plus, we had a blast. The workshop was an incredibly fun challenge, a learning experience I'll never forget, and a perfect way to spend a day with a good friend. And it would also be a perfect way to spend a day making a new friend. Jordan is the perfect guide for this journey. Not only is he passion-driven, not only does he have a wealth of knowledge for his craft, but he's also an enthusiastic and graciously patient teacher, especially well-equipped to lead even the most novice of students, like me. Jordan travels all around the country teaching his craft. He literally wrote the book on making Viking axes. What a badass. I cannot give a higher recommendation for Crooked Path Forge's workshops. It's an experience that will last a lifetime. And, as I mentioned, the blades, axes, and various custom builds that come out of Crooked Path Forge are stunning, not only in their beauty, but in their quality. Do yourself a favor. Check out crookedpathforge.org, and you will find these remarkable works of art, and you will find the schedule for the various workshops offered there. And when you make your purchases, please use the promo code FINDAHAMMER, 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 for a special Find a Way 10% discount. Thanks for listening. On with the show. This is a travelogue, a chronicle of life's journeys and the bits of wisdom gathered along the path. This is a sketch, a perpetually unfinished portrait of a community of explorers. This is a guide to curiosity and wonder setting off from Gainesville, Florida. This is Find a Way. Our guest this week is Connor Mitchell, nurturing dad dedicated to making space for the clunkiness of youth, devoted partner who says, "I love you," and the kind of friend who will yes and my jokes just as fervently as he does my hopes and dreams. Connor's a seeker guided by curiosity, a journeyman undaunted by anomalous paths, an artist who ignores the boundaries of genre, and a therapist who is far too good at getting me to talk too much. Stick around at the end of the episode for one of Connor's original tunes. Thank you for finding your way here today. Enjoy.
Yeah, right. I am, but, you know, not out of any firm preference.
I don't have to be.
Right.
Whatever your creative process is, I'm in.
Yeah, listen, just don't question me too much here, okay? I've got a little magic going here. This is your seat.
This is where I sit?
This is your seat.
Yes.
And get you comfortable.
Audrey, if you hear crying, is that okay with you?
Oh, yeah.
Great.
It's going
to be him, not me.
I mean, either one of you.
It's going to be him crying.
Either one of you. It's up to you. You guys are adults.
Coward.
Take care of yourself.
What are we going to do?
What do you want to do?
I don't know. What do you want to do?
Let me turn off my phone. You know.
I have not listened to any of the previous episodes.
Good.
I don't know if that was
okay. Clean.
All right. Ignorantly clean.
Yeah.
So you're
not
clean.
You're not aware of the murder mystery that has arisen.
I'm not. I'm going in real time.
So let me catch you up.
In episode two, you were heavily implicated.
Yeah, so I have some questions for you. No, this is, there's no preamble. There's no special.
Okay.
This is, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right.
Yeah. You just had band practice.
I did.
How's that going? You guys are very dedicated. You do it every week.
Well, we've done it 3 weeks in a row now after probably 6 weeks off, but
yeah, you gotta take a break.
We're trying. Yeah.
I still think of it like you and Lexi are pretty dedicated. Even like Lexi, I know right now is super busy getting ready for the art show.
Yeah.
And
yeah. I mean, we are on probably year three of this band that hasn't played a single show, and yeah, there's only two of us. So if we let the momentum go, it goes real quick.
Yeah. You're the only drivers of the,
yeah,
of the caravan.
So I think some of it comes from that, and knowing that if you kind of let in even legitimate excuses, you kind of have to double down that next week, because yeah, it's a slippery fish to catch. And once you don't got it, it swims away fast. The cool thing about this is it's the roots of just how we met. And I think the longer we've stayed with it, the more the kind of only overriding principle has been, this is what happens when the two of us get together. So if it feels good to both of us, cool. And that happens, it hopefully is proving to be kind of unique.
Yeah.
In that way, like that's the only real parameter to it.
That's cool. Do you guys have a band name?
Soft Opening right now.
Soft Opening.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. We'll see.
That's like,
we'll see if we keep with that.
Yeah. That's hitting me on a couple levels.
Such as?
Suddenly it's sensual.
Yes. Like, it's weirdly sensual, right?
Immediately I think of like, you know, the business approach, you know, the soft opening. And yeah, then it's like, oh, soft opening.
Yeah.
That's sexy.
And there's this weird, yeah, there's a weird, hopefully, balance between it being sexy and then really boneheaded and like
but also
fuzzed out rock and roll.
But also, like the third thing that hits me is like an emotional element, like soft opening, mm-hmm, like opening yourself up.
Totally.
You know, and like that, like vulnerability.
Yeah.
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 That's good. That's great.
Yeah. And growing into being partners on multiple levels, supporting each other in that way, is hopefully what even just aesthetically, like hopefully that's what's coming out. Super quick. Was I supposed to notice that we were recording this whole time?
Yeah. I mean, yes.
You didn't give me a 3-2 silent one point. There was no red light.
I'll tell you what. I started recording as soon as I heard Lola start barking. When you guys pulled in, I just said, okay, I'm just going to start now so I don't forget.
Coverage.
Yeah.
I got to get coverage. Yeah. Okay, great.
Even better.
I'm doing this in real time.
Tell me
if this isn't accurate to you, because this is hazy memories from the outside. But I feel like when I first started visiting Gainesville, mid-90s, late-90s, and maybe this is just the music that I was exposed to, but there was hardback and kind of a strong DIY, essentially kind of punk rock type thing. And then there was The Dish, which had so much of that 90s, you know, college rock thing happening.
Yeah.
And that was, and even the, I guess my memories of, I don't know, you know, the different magazines that were out, or, you know, newspapers were out here, local rags and stuff, though, that's what they were focused on. And that felt like the Gainesville music scene to me for a time there.
Yes.
Then late 90s, early 2000s, not even with any negative intent, but like things dipped.
Yeah.
And I guess I see a lot of that through certain venues that were rising at that time, other venues that were closing down. But my outside impression of, I'm going to clump you in with some other bands, tell me if that was accurate or not, but there was like Y'all, Morning Bell, there was like Umoja Orchestra there for a little.
Yeah, I think that was a little bit later, but okay. Yes. Yeah.
But there was kind of this like Orange and Brew thing happening.
Oh yeah.
Were you guys playing more on campus then?
We played on campus a little bit. We played.
You guys seemed more UF collegiate, young and UF oriented to me than, I don't know, the more grizzled older bands in town.
I mean, we certainly did
play. We played Orange and Brew, and we would play a couple of different bands I was in would play at the Rights Union. Yeah, we'd play the Rights Union, like some of the bigger shows that we play. But I think, you know, when I think back to like early 2000s, I mostly remember playing the Sidebar.
Okay.
That was a place we played a lot.
I played the Sidebar a lot. Yep.
And Common Grounds.
Okay.
And which was
the newer old one.
Yeah. The one that replaced Covered Dish. Okay. Yeah. Purple Porpoise. I think one of the first shows we ever played was Alligator Rocks, which was a mistake.
I played a 7-minute show there.
Did you really?
Well, it was like a showcase for different bands, you know, yeah. We were playing almost at the end of the night.
God, the
and
worst.
They basically were like, we'd been waiting for, you know, 3.5 hours or something. Oh, and they were like, I don't know if you guys even want to play. Like, you probably shouldn't even play. So fuck that. We're playing.
Yes.
And they're like, okay, you have 7 minutes.
Which band was this?
That was Brickfoot Ninja Squad, which was my first kind of instrumental funky college band.
What were the bands that you were like, I'm sure it was many, but what were the bands that you had?
That was earlier? So that literally was like my first kind of, I'm going to make a band with friends and roommates at that time.
Yeah.
And just kind of build it up from scratch, which, in hindsight was just amazing. Like, just jam. And
yeah,
I did not have a whole lot of skills. I mean, most of us had only learned our instruments recently before, you know.
Yeah.
It's maybe quote unquote what you should have done in high school, and I was more into hooligan stuff then. This was a little bit delayed, but very pure.
Yeah.
Right. And at that time there was this kind of like, I don't know, funky, kind of jammy little scene happening.
Definitely.
So we were part of that. And then around that time met a guy who had become a good buddy that we played, just started playing a lot of free improv, really noisy, really odd at times. You know, every time we got together, it would be like different instruments and different type setups. And he had a recording studio here in town out of his house. So every time we played, we would record.
That's fun.
So we were doing that for a while.
Do you have those recordings?
I do.
Do you ever listen?
Yeah. And there's some really cool stuff on there, which is, you know, there's a whole lot of stuff that's maybe not so great, but that was, you know, hit record and go type stuff. And I really fell in love with free improv and, having no idea where that would go. So we would do tons of like one-off type bands with people in that. And then helped a good friend, start a band called Loaded for Bear that was like, punk rock kind of, you know, Fugazi influenced, Drive Like Jehu kind of shellac influenced, heavy punk rock music.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was great. And did that for a number of years. And then, left Gainesville right towards the end of that. So
okay.
2006, tons of buddies in other bands. And, you know, by that time, I think had met people a little bit more involved with you guys and Morning Bell kids, I'll say, at that time.
Yeah, the Morning Bell kids.
I'm sure they're, I mean, shoot, Eric's my age. But
now that they have kids.
Yeah. But yeah, I think at that time, like even associating that a little bit with my little brother and my sister-in-law. And so I'm realizing as I talk about this, I think some of this even to me felt generational. Right. There was like a big slackerdom Gen X thing happening that I would be more on the very tail end of, but informed, you know, very, very 90s.
Yes.
Hang on in Gainesville. And you guys were so innocent and hopeful and like positive in this really interesting way, you know. Hi, nice to meet you. I'm going to shake your hand, you know.
Yeah, I definitely
in a town
still
that,
like that
felt scenestery to me quite a bit at that time. So there was something like, you can do that? What? You know, on one hand, default, how dare you? And on the other hand, right. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There doesn't have to be cool culture scene here. And that I think is beautiful about Gainesville. Those things were coexisting.
Yeah. I think that time in life really taught me some great lessons about, I'm not sure if I understood it back then, but I think it taught me some great lessons about just what
what something that is good can be. You know, like, I think in high school and early years of college, I had this idea that, like, it's not good enough to be, it's not good enough to be a band that's popular. You have to be popular with, like, cool people, you know? And early on, or like with Maxwell Edison, I remember building up a pretty good fan base. Like, we would, you know, we would get crowded shows, good numbers at the shows. And I remember thinking, like, these are, I mean, there's, all these people are really cool, but not just what I thought of as being cool, but we're all really having a fun time. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is just fun. And, like, just kind of slowly realizing, like, I think I'm wrong about what cool is. I think I'm wrong about, I don't know, like, it was me shedding, I think, what was put on me in high school, which was this idea of, like, it's not, there's a certain way to be cool, and there's a certain way to act to be cool, and it's just not that way. The people who act that way, I'm sure, what ended up being the common denominator in someone who I think is quote-unquote cool is someone who's just actually being themselves.
Right.
And some of those people match up with the stereotype of cool, and some of those people come nowhere near it.
Right.
And those people are fucking cool. Maybe those people are cooler because they're not, you know, like, it's harder, you know?
And in theory, I would rep that, right?
Yes. You know,
I'd hear Minutemen sing about that and be like, I'm a corn dog too, right?
Right.
Like, and then doing it, especially in one's early 20s or in my early 20s, eye language, please. my early to mid 20s was hard. Yeah. I mean, felt really, so much of this is in hindsight, about how safe it felt at times to speak the language of a very particular subculture.
Right.
Right. So that, like, okay, I know the code words to get into various, get behind various gates, and very cool stuff potentially is going to happen in there. But I think it's a trap too of, you know, well, at least I'm not the high school jock. Right. But you are remnants of the high school jerk. You are still, you know, even though you're not wearing the jersey, you're still kind of territorial, you know, dickish toward people that you don't know. I mean, upon leaving Gainesville, I will say, I was like, right. Everybody who, I don't know, pretends to forget names or doesn't really know where they've met me before or not. And going like, what is that? In other places, people would be like, right, you know, we met 2.5 years ago at so-and-so's barbecue. Or someone would say, you know, in another city would go, I know we've met, I'm sorry, I'm spacing on your name. And I'd be like, oh, right, that's an okay thing to do.
Yes.
I acknowledge your presence.
Yes.
We've bumped into each other somewhere in the past, and that's okay. And in this strange way, I didn't always feel that in Gainesville, in the cool places.
Right.
But if you don't care and you can name your band after a Beatles song or a Radiohead song and go like, that's, I'm cool with doing that.
Sure.
I'm allowed to do that.
Yeah.
There is a release of potential baggage of, I gotta appear, I have to keep up appearances.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's, I think it's so appropriate and in that appropriately ironic that keeping up appearances upon reflection is the most cringeworthy thing. it's like you sold out the present for the future, you know? And I think that's like some of the biggest shame that I carry when it comes to that time is, you know, looking back and being like, oh yeah, I started getting full of myself. I started thinking like I was cool, started thinking that, and started allowing that to influence how I valued other people and how I valued just good things. And I it's so frustrating because I feel as though, as I mentioned before, like sitting, you know, when we would, you know, sophomore, junior year of college, we're all sitting up on a stage and there's like a ton of people and they're all different and they're all like their own version of cool and having a really good time. It was like the universe was sort of like giving me like, see, this is what's cool. This is what's fun. And I was getting it and getting it and getting it. And somehow I decided at some point being like, yeah, well,
But how could you not take advantage of it, right? If right. I think you just said it really beautifully. It was given to you.
Right. Yeah.
Well, how, I can't truly appreciate the value of that if I... I'm not saying I didn't have to work for it. When the right. feeling is that it's given
right.
rather than I uncovered this, I discovered this.
Right.
I just stumbled into this and it kind of fell into my lap
yeah.
based on who was living next door to me at the dorm or yes. whose girlfriend was roommates with so-and-so, right?
right?
Maybe you have to, one has to lose it to then rediscover it consciously.
Sure.
Right? So I'm curious, do you think that this behavior that we're talking about is exacerbated in small towns, small communities, small subcultures, or, you know, I mean, you were going to find it in Williamsburg, Brooklyn too.
Sure.
But like, was it more virulent here?
I don't know if it has to do with the location. I mean, it definitely has to do with location, but I turned myself around and started seeing things more clearly, at least according to my perspective now, when I recognize the value of how important this small bubble is, just as important mm-hmm. as the bigger bubble, right? So like, I don't need 1,000 people to show up for a show and tell. Some of our best show and tells have been like 6 people.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll sit and like have a really good conversation in the bar. And I'll come home and feel so rewarded and so wonderful. Hmm. And so the happiness that you can have with your creation is only distorted when you start looking for the validation outside of it. Being in a small town, I think it's possible that this podcast is the greatest podcast that's ever been made in the history of the world. But if the only people who ever listen to it are in Gainesville, Florida, that's not failure. You know, that's fine. That's secondary.
But how will I know if it's the greatest podcast in the world if the whole world doesn't hear about it and validate it one way or the other and say, yes, you passed or no, you failed.
Even if they do validate it, you don't know.
Right.
You
totally.
Know? I mean, mm-hmm. I think it's just all perception, which I think can be really disappointing to some people when they hear that. Like a lot of people push back pretty heavy on that perspective. And I don't mean for it to. It's a relief for me.
What is the pushback? That there's an objective truth to.
Yeah.
This is measurable.
Right.
Quantifiable.
And I understand that because I think a lot of people have kind of made their life's work pursuing that greatness, you know? And it's kind of where they've put their bullseye for success is like getting a bestseller or getting a gold record or being a movie star or, you know, whatever it is to them that's their dream. And if they don't get their dream, then it's failure.
Mm.
I don't feel totally comfortable saying like you're wrong because it's your dream,
yeah.
you know, but I try to work up some compassion for that because I think they're missing a lot of what's great about just the process itself or just okay. existence itself. And then this whole like trophy that you get, I think usually doesn't pay the emotional bill.
Doesn't seem to.
I don't think so. Yeah.
Right. It seems very stereotypical to then go, oh, this is wax fruit. There's no actual nutriment to
right.
this.
Yeah. And when I'm 80 years old, am I going to be able to turn to that wax fruit and say like, see, it's proof that I'm great. Or am I going to just be happy sitting with my headphones on in the corner listening to my conversation with Connor, mm-hmm. you know, and being like, oh, this fucking guy, you know, like, you know, especially if, you know, I got my great grandkids or something coming in at this age, probably just grandkids or maybe no kids, who knows, but having this younger generation come in and saying like, I've got this trophy here. Uh-huh. Yeah. Listen to what I made. And then being like, that fucking sucks, grandpa. they must have had like shitty standards back then, as opposed to just like, I don't give a fuck about the trophy or what you think about this recording. You know, it's just... this is a thing that like evokes joy in me. That to me, I think, is the objective standard. It's just, it can't be objective because it's not for everybody. So by definition, it's subjective.
Yeah, but isn't there something awesome about it being your thing and it's your joy?
Yes.
Right? Like if the barometer for this is Colin's joy, that is a filtering agent that I hope is not apologetically there, or you know, kind of surreptitiously there.
Oh, yeah.
Like that should be.
Yeah, no apology, okay. For sure.
The more inherent that is to the process, to my mind, the better.
So 100% my way forward with this is just making episodes that I like. Mm. Like after you and I talk, when I sit down and listen and make my choices about whatever our episode comes out like, which is going to be very much like this, which maybe is just laziness. But all I know is like, I want to be just happy with it. You know, I want to have that thing where, you know, like when I record a song, mm-hmm. I listen to that song over and over and over again. And like to the point of over satiation, you know, like to the point, like I have to stop myself from listening to it. And then like a year later, I'll be like, no, I should listen to that song again. And then I listen to it over and, you know, like I get such
with
joy.
Enjoyment?
Yeah. I mean, so there's definitely like, oh God, I wish I'd done that different or something like that. But you mentioning, you know, music, recording mm-hmm. music, that goes into the same category, the same bucket that we were talking about before with stuff that will, I think, pay emotional dividends for the rest of my life. I'll be able to go back and listen to the Maxwell Edison album and hear it in each stage of my life and get a different experience from it and appreciate it, you know? Mm. And probably the time I appreciated it the least was like 5 years after recording it, you know, and hearing it be like, oh my God, I can't believe we did A, B, and C. And
sure.
There's like one song on there where our bassist and my good friend Steve brought up this thing that he didn't like, that it was an idea that I was doing in a song. And it was this background vocal part where I was going like, la, 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 you know, whatever. I thought it was really important to have in the song. And Steve was like, I think it's kind of throwing off the feel, you know, it's kind of getting in the way. And I was like, absolutely not. You know, like I know my vision.
Yes.
And so every time I listen to that song now, I will think Steve Lincoln was
totally
correct.
Right.
I should have taken that out. It was hubris, you know, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. But when I realized that 5 years after the album, 1 year after the album, I don't know what, that was pain. That was like, oh God, it ruined this recording.
Sure.
Now I listen to it and I'm like, oh, you silly boy, you know, and that's pleasure.
Because what's changed in the interim?
Just distance from it makes it feel less personal. It hurt more when I was closer to it because it was evidence of flaws in me that I wasn't maybe ready to. I think there was the early part of my life, it was much harder for me to admit fault. There was way more pressure in my mind to be perfect.
Yeah, that's the goal.
Right. And so now, sounds like I'm like building myself up here, but now I'm so, I don't, the fact that I am flawed is not only impossible to hide or deny, but it's also sort of, it's cathartic to recognize and to celebrate, you know. And mm-hmm. It would be great to be able to go back and say sorry to every single person I was flawed at. I fantasize about that a lot. I fantasize about apologies all the time. But in general though, I have a lot of gratitude for being in a place where I can be like, yep, I was dumb and I'm still dumb, but now I know about that dumbness. And so, you know, I'll probably learn about this stuff that I'm dumb about now later, and I'll be better at admitting it or better at, you know, trying to work with it.
You ever had anyone lovingly point out one of your flaws to the point where you could accept it?
Yes. Yes. And it was one of the, I can remember immediately, the one that popped in my head was my other bandmate, Jake McMullen, who played drums for Maxwell Edison. He pointed out to me one time, when I was making passive aggressive jokes, and I would make a joke, and that's just like, that was a way that I was sort of raised, mm-hmm. as passive-aggressive jokes. And a lot of the people that I was friends with in school, passive-aggressive jokes, it was just a thing.
Yeah, I'm pretty good at it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good skill.
Yeah, I know you are.
Yeah.
I'm still good at it, actually.
That was aggressive, aggressive.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. Well, get used to it. That's aggressive, aggressive.
Yeah.
But
it was a skill set. It was finely honed for you. You put a lot of hours into practicing it.
Yeah. 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 It was. And the common defense is like, man, I'm just joking.
That's right.
Just joking.
Man, I don't know why you're being so sensitive.
Yeah,
sure.
Come on, man, come on. And I just remember Jake one day sitting down with me and saying, like, just because you're joking doesn't mean it doesn't hurt. And man, that really, that hit me. It's hitting me hard right now.
It's brave to say that out loud.
Yeah. Yeah. And he was, friend. I mean, he was pissed at me at
yeah,
the time,
sure.
Of course, but he was right, you know? And I think that was really that was one of the nicest things anybody ever did for me, was just kind of pointing out this thing. And it wrecked me in a way, because all of a sudden I was like, man, I have been hurting a lot of people that I love.
That's, you know, very unsexy
yeah.
to see yeah. more clearly.
Yeah.
I really grapple with this one, but my default, largely unconscious assumption is that the people who are closest to me and who love me the most, who I have quite a few of them in my life, love me because of my positive traits and how perfect I am.
Right.
When that is just not the case at all. They are totally
right.
Apparently accepting of all of those flaws.
Yeah.
Even the ones that they really don't like.
Yes.
At some level, especially the ones who've hung out now for a while, are going, yeah, that's part of the crazy admixture that makes Connor Connor.
Yeah.
And like, I might bitch and complain about that one a little bit more. I might tell you, you know, hey, okay, I love you and turn down the volume on that particular part. But apparently they're accepting the package deal, right?
Yeah.
In a way that I lag way far behind in for myself.
Yeah.
You know, I would not admit to, and I'm trying to, I think I don't have as much hubris as I used to about this is achievable, some sort of, self-perfection, which actually means being able to hide all of those flaws and my insecurities about them. And then realizing, for all of my smarts and all my sophistication and all of the strategies and manipulations, A, that's not possible. B, even if it were possible, I'm not good enough at it.
Oh, wow.
To hide that from
right.
everyone around me, right? Basically, I could trick you enough into really liking me, because I like it when you see this part.
Sure.
So I'm just going to keep showing you that part.
Yeah.
Pretty darn ignorant of how intimately that part is revealing this other part that I don't want anybody to see. But, you know, my loved ones have pretty intimate access to that shadow.
Yes.
And apparently are fairly wholeheartedly endorsing it.
But I think, and what stresses me out about the ones that that I share those shadows with, or that shadow with, is that they're also exposed to the most harm.
Sure.
You know, I had a roommate for 7 years, like starting in college and out of college, my friend Austin. And I think of him as somebody who probably received some of the worst parts of me.
Mm-hmm.
during this like transformation time of my life. And I received a lot of his too.
Sure.
Cause we were working shit out, and we were also trying to be cool to each other. Still trying to be, I remember, we were roommates, when we were living in this apartment together, we both read the book Shogun.
Uh-huh.
Have you ever read that book?
Yes.
And we were simultaneously enamored with Torunaga.
Okay.
Because Torunaga was this scheming and like all knowing and subtle, you know, and guy. And he would he would just say like a little something and it would like start a war, he would read into somebody's words and like totally understand what was going to happen next and be able to plan 5 steps ahead and do all that. He's such a cool character in the book. And I remember realizing that Austin and I had started to Torunaga each other. Just because like we fucking love this book and love this character and want to be that cool, yeah, that smart, that wise, you know, all that stuff. And I feel like we both, I don't mean to speak for him. He might hear this and be like, what are you talking about? I didn't do any of that. But I know that for me, I thought like, that's the height of cool. It's like being able to suss out little bits and pieces, be passive aggressive as well. Like just slip in a little thing here or whatever it is.
Right.
I really wish I hadn't done that. I really, because I think so much of like working yourself out in the midst of your loved ones means hurting them, you know, yeah, with your crap. And so like Austin and I still think of Austin as like one of my closest friends. And I think he probably thinks of me the same way, but I think we both know that like, there is like that damage done at that time, and we had to like go recover separately.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure.
And so thankfully, you know, now, you know, I don't know how many years later now, 15 years later, I think a lot of that has healed, and we both are in a better place to be that way. But that created a fear for me with the next loved ones that I'd be with, where I'd share that. And so it took a lot for me to realize like, nope, just gonna have to do that with them too.
Yeah.
Just gonna have to share it all and accept that they still love me. Accept that they still like want to be around this like crazy mixture of good stuff and bad stuff.
But that next round, do you think you're as strategic? You still trying to protect in that?
I like Toranaga strategic. Yeah. No. Yeah. No. Uh-huh. I let go of that. That's a bad way to go.
I mean, to me, that kind of summarizes my 20s and probably a good chunk of my 30s.
Yes.
Is if I can just get the strategy right.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, yes, if I study the chess game of life enough, I will know the moves. That's why he's so friggin' cool, is that he never gets caught, and right, he never, you know, within the manipulations that I'm playing on a level that y'all can't even understand.
Right.
And I was like, right, mastery. Okay, I can get mastery. And then that means I can do whatever the fuck I want.
Yes.
I have carte blanche, yes, too. And I'll handle it ethically. I'm not going to use that against people.
No, I know.
But
what
it
mean.
Will just make sure that
you get some
from
good
the perspective
shit.
Of that, right? That I'll never be targeted. It means that I can never actually, you know, catch an arrow. Like I'll just be, you know, I can turn predator invisible when I need to. But I'll use my powers for good. I promise, right? Like until you're like, okay, or I have wasted, maybe not wasted, because here we are having this conversation, but the feeling, I've wasted a lot of time on a strategy that is so inherently flawed.
Right.
And so impossible.
Yeah.
And maybe that energy needs to burn itself out to that point where you finally go, okay, enough.
Yeah.
I just don't want to actually do that anymore. Therefore, the only alternative, which I think is brave, but also extremely vulnerable, is to go, all right, then I won't strategize. I'll right. try and show up a little bit more degrees of nakedness.
Sure. It's so funny though to think about like even with this, like with Toranaga, it's all written out right in front of you to see, like, this isn't what you want to do.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the whole point, like one of the main themes of that book is talking about how in this culture in Japan at that time, at least, I don't know if it's considered part of their culture now, but like, you know, they would talk about how they have three hearts. You know, they've got the heart that they show everybody, the heart that they show their closest friends and family, and then they have their secret heart that nobody sees ever. Yeah. And I, of course, I think everybody's got a version of that, you know, no matter how much you try to be open. But to emphasize so much a character defined by that secret heart, to make your whole, you know, the whole drive of what you are and who you are to be like, nobody's gonna know this thing in
right.
me. I should have known from the start. Like, that's not what I want. That's eternal loneliness. That's, you know, it's such a, it takes, you know, I think people dismiss the strength it takes to be closed off. You know, they say, oh, it's a weakness. Mm-hmm. And it is, you know, it's a fear. It is a version of weakness. It still takes a ton of energy and a ton of strength to do
God,
it.
Yeah. Right. You know, constant maintenance.
It's not to sure. be like scoffed, you know, mm-hmm. but not desired, you mm-hmm. know, not, ultimately for me, not what I want. My dream is to be, like you said, like just to be completely naked for as many people as possible. And that like makes a lot of people uncomfortable. You know, a lot of people are like, I don't want to see you naked, you know, or hear you naked, or, you know, I don't literally mean walk around naked.
No, this is such a good soundbite. It's going to be really good for your opening 10 seconds of this podcast. I want as many people as possible to see me utterly, completely naked.
Well, I do. I have to say, though, I do have a bit of a obsession's not the word, but like I have a keen interest in the idea of nakedness, you know, just literal nakedness, you know, the human body being naked. There's something about it that is, my way of explaining it to Audrey is that like when we're walking the dog at night and people have their windows open and lights on inside, no matter who is in there, and actually no matter if they're naked or not, like I'm interested. Like I like the idea of seeing people like in a natural state without any barriers
no
put
pretense, up. Pretense, yeah.
I don't like, you know, I'm not interested. I'm not bringing binoculars. I'm not like sitting in my room with a telescope.
You're not outright peeping.
No, but there is a certain satisfaction I get seeing strangers or people I know, whatever, in a state where like they're just being themselves without a care of what someone else thinks or is doing or whatever.
Yeah.
And the joke with Audrey is that like, I'm also like, there's like the little boy in me that's always hoping that there's like a beautiful woman naked in the window.
Sure,
and you're just like, well, too. I just like hit the jackpot. Right. But I've realized that like, yeah, that's great, you know, for this one part of me, but all nakedness is really fascinating to me. Just the idea, like yesterday I went to the gym and I went to the locker room, and when I walked in to put my bag in a locker, there was this guy who is like by no means traditionally handsome or like fit or anything like that. And I say traditionally with the heavy T there, like I don't really give a shit what is traditionally handsome or whatever, but there is a standard. Yep. And this guy did not fit it. And he was just standing buck naked in front of his locker, not facing his locker, but facing out toward everybody else. And he was just applying deodorant very slowly and sort of like, you could tell that he was just like zoning out. And I just thought like, and I didn't stare or anything. I'm not like, I'm going to look at this guy as he's putting on his deodorant. But there's just this moment where I looked and I was like, this is a really interesting moment for this guy. Like this person obviously has no care in the world about anybody. Yeah, he's just sitting there like applying his deodorant. Obviously, he must have worked out really hard and he's kind of like zoning out as he's getting ready to go out into his day. And this is like this moment of zen while there's like 15 other guys around like getting dressed. And I'm thinking about this. And then like probably at the end of my workout, when I went back in, I overhear these two younger guys, probably like high school or young college guys, talking about how like, so fucking weird that guys get naked in here. Like, what the fuck's the matter with them? And like, this is so fucking gross. And like, and just thinking like, man, and these two guys like are traditionally like good looking guys, sure, like real, you know, close cut haircuts and like whatever, like muscular and all V-shaped. That stuff. And I was like, man, this is like such a great example of the difference in beauty. You know, like here's a guy who doesn't match up with that. And that is, I prefer that beauty over this other beauty any day. And like to feel such like pity for these ridiculously handsome dudes who probably, you know, are very popular with whatever people are attracted to them or they're attracted to. I'm sure they get tons of action. Mm-hmm. And to pity those people, especially considering how I felt towards those guys when I was in college and thinking like, man, I wish I looked like that.
Yeah.
Oh, man, you know, what a great like arc, you know, to get to recognize like, this guy just like zoning out, putting on deodorant.
You ever felt like slow deodorant guy?
Good question. Yeah. Yeah. I feel like that. I, maybe not like naked in the locker room. I mean, I let myself get naked in the locker room and sometimes I challenge myself to like walk from the shower to my locker without the towel on. And I'll think like, okay, I'm doing it. Here's the thing. I have a fear in the back of my mind And it's less so because I haven't been teaching in the public schools for a while now. But when I was teaching in the public school, I was always worried that like one of my students was going to be in there. Sure. And like, I just feel like one of your students sees you naked, there's just like no going back.
Yeah.
There's something weird about that. But yeah, but there are definitely times where I feel like I probably look pretty weird to a group of people and I'm feeling okay with it, or I'm feeling like loosey about it. Yeah.
I don't know if I've ever felt that way a day in my life.
Like comfortable like that?
That comfortable.
Yeah.
In that context, and I don't even necessarily mean the physical nudity, although that certainly represents that.
Yeah.
But allowing oneself to do that is so I don't like luxurious or something.
It is luxurious. So, you're right.
I think it's beautiful and I'm all for it. And protective parts of Miko, that is so rude. Not showing your balls to everybody.
There's a difference.
Rude, yeah. Of like how that you, what the permission you're giving yourself there, and to so genuinely go, if someone else had a problem with this, that is their problem.
Yeah.
Like I want to get there. I mean, there are times probably not in the gym locker room, but there are times in other versions where I'm steadily working toward that. And I've had experiences in that area. I think you're highlighting something really beautiful, because the real motherfucker about it is, for me, knowing that if you're going to be slow deodorant guy, in that same locker room are going to be the two gym bros, yep, absolutely condemning you for your actions.
Right.
Right. Like, I want to be slow deodorant guy, but I want to do it without facing the condemnation of those guys. And I wouldn't, the power I give their opinion happens so fast and unconsciously and is so rooted in childhood bullying and a bunch of other things that that make me want to be a gatekeeper, that make me want to be aware of kind of all the rules of a subculture, so that, because it's interesting, as you said, kind of like, I don't want that. 10 minutes ago, whatever it was, I was going, yeah, but 25-year-old me, 22-year-old me, 20-year-old me absolutely wanted that.
Yeah.
Absolutely wanted that level of perceived protection,
yeah,
no matter what the payment was for it. It's interesting never having, I mean, I think it's an impossibility to actually get it. And the lesson is like, yeah, no, this is not the character in the book that you actually want to be modeling yourself after. But yeah, no, I do. Right. I want to be Darth Vader. I want to be protected in, yes, in that suit. That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
No one would fuck with me. Right. Yeah. Like, that was a goal, precisely because how hurtful the gym bros condemnation is going to be.
Right.
Like having to walk that gauntlet, having to go like, those coals are that hot and you would have to walk across them if you were truly going to be slow deodorant guy.
Yes.
That's one thing to say and another thing to do.
Well, and I think there's an aspect to it that kind of helps me, and it's just the way my brain works sometimes. The only way I can explain it is, like, I think about how our dog Lola looks at me when I might be doing something that I think is totally normal, and she's like, "What the fuck are you doing?" You know, and she like worries about it, or vice versa. Actually, like, Lola's licking her ass. And I'm like, God, that is horrible. And she's just like, are you kidding me? This is great.
Yeah.
I'm loving it. If I could do this more, if I could reach further, I would, you know, lick my ass more.
Yeah.
That sort of like those guys who judge, you know, your nakedness and put you down for it, they go back and lick their ass later, you know? Mm. And I think to myself, like, yeah, why do I give a shit about what they think? You know, like, why, not to say that they're like insignificant people. They're not insignificant. They're by definition significant because they're making us change our behaviors and things like that. But, they're just as significant as anybody else, right? You know, they're just as,
they're not any more significant, you mean?
I should say, yeah, they're not any more significant.
Okay.
And I think this is like where the peace comes from, just deciding that there isn't like objective coolness or anything like that. What seems to be the closest thing I can get to objective coolness is comfort with oneself, you know? Like the real Torunaga, the real cool version of Torunaga is the one that, the fact that he's just like so confident in himself.
Right.
And like, so I can take that. I want to be that Torunaga. I want to be that confident. I want to believe that it matters enough to do all these orchestrations because like I matter and I, you know, am good or whatever it is. But I don't have to take on the other aspects of like secrecy or, you know, hiding or honor or those kind of things that can honor to others. As long as I'm honorable to myself, you know, then that makes sense.
But I think there's an adversarial stance required to protect yourself in that way. Like I'm thinking about the privilege that Jim Bro get, like why am I largely unconscious parts of me scared of that? Because they have the court of public opinion. Mm. Like they get to walk into a public area and go, as you say, like there is a standard, whether it's in alignment with your aesthetics or not.
Sure.
Right. And of course it can, should, and sometimes is deeply challenged, but there's a standard.
Right.
And that Jim Bro guy gets to slide in a way of going, yeah, but I'm condemning this dude's grossness and anybody could objectively see that this is gross. They get to pull that off more than slow deodorant guy going, I actually really enjoy the aesthetics of my body.
Yeah.
And I'm round in different ways and I have, you know, a scar over here and my genitalia is bigger or not as big as the commonly accepted standard. Yeah, right. And that's y'all's problem.
Right.
Like, to me, that feels, you have to fiercely defend that somehow. You have to be adversarial. You have to be against that stream somehow. I don't know.
And like,
I don't know that it doesn't mean it can't happen with grace and it can't happen gently, but the unapology it takes to be fully naked, slowly applying your deodorant. And who knows? I don't know. In 30 seconds, maybe he wakes up and goes, what am I doing? And
yeah, quickly, it could be that. Yeah, maybe.
But whatever was happening beautifully in that moment that I think you're capturing, that has to be defended my language is sloppy here.
No, but I think that's it. I'm interested that that's like where you're coming from with it. And cause it, I see what you mean and it's not something I expected you to feel. And yet like, as you're saying it, I see how you got there. Mm-hmm. And there is that. I get it. Like I feel a little bit of that. I think that there are limitations to my acceptance of this kind of bravado, I guess you could call it. The gym provides many opportunities for reflection on this. I can remember many, many years ago going into the gym locker room one morning and seeing a guy probably in his like 50s or so with his leg up on, he's totally naked, his legs up on the sink counter, and he's shaving his balls. Just like out in the open for everybody's just shaving his balls. And that was, I can connect with you on this, like, you need to defend yourself here. Like, this is, like, it seems to me that shaving your balls is something you do in your bathroom and not in, like, the line of six sinks with a mirror. And
I hear you. Actually, what I'm saying is, even for that guy to do that, he has to have a level of defense against social norming. I'm going to shave my balls here and I don't care who knows it.
Right.
And if you have a problem with it, that's your problem. Even if, and maybe like perhaps the most appropriate response to someone else trying to condemn you, right? Or uphold a standard to you that you don't want to co-sign is to go like, whatever. But even in the, you know what I mean? So it doesn't have to be, you know, I refuse to take this. I'm mad as hell. Like, even if the energy is like, whatever, that feels so against the popular current of that stream that I somehow, like, how can that not be revolutionary? How can that not be
disruptive? It is disruptive. It is. I mean, and in a great way. I mean, it's been disruptive for me. It's helped me knowing that dude shaving his balls, like put his pants on and probably went to some, you know, he's probably like a doctor or, you know, a lawyer or something like that. He's probably some successful person. And just knowing like, yeah, okay. So I guess shaving your balls in public doesn't define you. You know, it did to me. That's the only way I know this person. but I think another great response to, like, hey, what the hell are you doing? You know, standing there naked, putting on your deodorant slowly. a great response is like, what's wrong? Like, what have I done wrong? Mm-hmm. You know, or like, what are you asking me to apologize for?
Right.
Right. And that was something, you know, as somebody who has struggled with my body image my whole life, seeing other people with similar bodies as me without second thought, like take their shirt off to go into the pool. Yeah. And just doing it, or just seeing, like, that's one of the most healing things that I've experienced in the last 20 years or so, seeing like, so many people from the younger generation, like celebrating different body shapes and mm-hmm. sizes and things like that. And when I say celebrate, I don't react really well when somebody's like, look at me, I'm sexy, I'm great, or anything like that. I don't think that they shouldn't feel that way. Mm-hmm. I just, it's hard for me to deal with anybody. I don't care if they're like six-pack abs and, you know, muscles and all that stuff. Anybody who's walking around saying like, look at me, I'm great, I'm sexy, and you want me, isn't to me. You mm-hmm. know, like, that's not it. But it's wonderful to see all kinds of people happy and in love and, you know, out there and shirtless or naked or, you know, in a bikini or in Speedos or mm. whatever it is. Like, it's disruptive to a really negative system. And mm-hmm. like what you're talking about as having to have this like drive against a system, you know?
Yeah. I think the reason that I am trying to emphasize that is to feel how like the risk behind that
yeah.
is real
yeah.
and the inherent, the feeling of danger, whether it's an actual danger to, you know, to my well-being or not would yeah. be another question, but the protective response that comes up to go like, you can't, like, you shouldn't do that. You're going to be too disruptive. Things that are disruptive in that way have a tendency to get targeted, get attacked, get shut down, get
yeah.
eliminated.
Yeah. Unless you're just like, oh shit, what was I just doing? I'm sorry.
I guess, right? But yeah, I don't know what the acceptable level of zoning out,
right?
Dick first, as opposed to ass first, to the rest of the gym.
That alone, yeah, that alone was a dynamic that changed yeah. the whole story.
Yeah,
yeah. I still have the instinctive like middle school. I gotta like, if I just face my locker and don't right, see anybody see sure. me, then nobody saw me.
Right,
right. It's like quantum nakedness.
Ostrich in the sand, nakedness. Yes. I don't know how we got here.
That's good.
Okay, great.
There's something that you said earlier that I don't know if this is something you say often or if it's something that you heard somewhere, but for it really hit me and I really love it and I immediately want to adopt it. But you were talking about showing our flaws to people that we care about and accepting the fact that they see those flaws and experience those flaws and they still love you. But the phrase that you used was, I love you and, which I think is like the greatest adaptation of like, yes. And uh-huh, energy, uh-huh. like, I love you. And as opposed to like, 'cause so often in relationships, the approach is like, I love you, but, sure. and I don't know why. But that phrase, I think, just like transformed a little something in my head.
I think, I do think it's connected to the improv, yes. And it, you know, full disclosure, I don't even know that it is conscious in me in this, but it's a pretty basic DBT
okay.
Skill to even just in the room that, you know, every time you say, but I'm going to remind you, and we're going to replace our buts with ands.
Yeah.
Because the but reinforces black and white thinking,
right.
You know, all or nothing thinking, and the entire point of trying to allow the dialectical to be there, allow polarized opposites to be there, is to open up the protective and defensively oriented response. At least that would be my interpretation of it.
Yeah.
So even just having the and, the possibility with and.
Yeah.
Right? When you say, I love you, but I have to shell up because whatever's coming after that is going to be apparently, you know, very sharp and targeted.
Yes.
I love you. And I go, I'm nervous. I feel vulnerable. Okay. What is it that you were going to say? Right. Yes. It's so much more open.
Right.
And it allows for things that on paper appear paradoxical, conceptually appear paradoxical, experientially to be much different.
Yeah.
I can't give you the slick metaphor as to why these things both coexist right now that appear to be polarized. Sunrise and sunset are both here at the same time. But experientially, I know they are. Yeah. I don't know why this, I don't know how to give you an idea of the gray between the black and the white is here, but I'm experiencing it in this moment. It's based in sensation. It's based in thought forms. It's based in my emotions. Therefore, I don't have to get caught in the conceptual, which is purely mental, around why it has to be this and can't be that.
Right.
It's not extractive and eliminating that way. It's inclusive and charged with potential somehow.
Charged with potential. Yes. Mm-hmm. That's a really good way of putting it. Yeah. The butt closes a door or the butt takes away, you know, it's like saying like, I got you this cupcake, but
right.
Yeah. You know, and it's like, well, okay, then I don't get the cupcake.
Yeah.
Immediately.
But it was $7. And I just want you to know how expensive this cupcake is.
So you still get it, but don't enjoy it because now that I spent.
Don't eat it in one bite. I need you to savor it. Right. And next time when you buy me a cupcake, don't get me this 50-cent cupcake.
Yeah,
because this one was $7. This is an artisanal, bespoke cupcake.
I really appreciate you. I love you anding me on that one. Uh-huh. No, I think I've got that energy with a lot of emotional work that I try to do with the people close to me. You know, in the last 10 years, I've tried to work out a lot of stuff within my family, you know, talking to my parents and my sister and I know that it's hard, like, especially as parents, it's hard to have your kid say, you know, this hurt me, that hurt me.
Sure.
I wish this was different. And it was, you know, it has been for my parents. And I think the main reason there has been the fear of the butt, the fear of, that's one of the things that I always felt so compelled to make sure I got across was none of this changes that I love you. None of this changes that, like, I'm grateful for you, anything. I'm trying to increase our understanding of our love for each other.
Well, you're doing a much better job of that than me then, because my 20s were of, you know, assaulting my parents for not being superheroes and not being impeccable, and showing me how human they were was pretty fiery about that. I was pretty poisonous about that.
I got fiery too.
There was a lot of butts and not a whole lot of ands.
It was a lot of butts.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, no, I don't mean to paint it like I did it perfect. And that's what I'm saying. I wish I could have, worded it like that. I hope you don't mind me. Of course you don't mind me sharing. You and I are both people who have benefited from like therapy and inner work like that.
Sure.
It is difficult conveying a lot of that stuff to different generations of people because especially like the baby boomer generation has a general stereotypical. So therefore not always accurate. but a general feeling that like therapy is like for crazy people or, you know, and that's not even like an appropriate term, but that's kind of their thinking.
That's a stereotype.
Yeah. And so to come to them and say like, even to say like, I've started therapy and to know, and in my case, like sometimes hear like, well, does that mean that, you know, it's my fault? Like, I did something wrong, you know, that kind of thing. All automatically creates like an uncomfortable dynamic for the discussion of, well, there are some things that happened with us that I'm realizing hurt, you know, that had an impact. And it's not always hard. It's not always easy to have that discussion in a really like emotionally stable way. I can remember one of the first times I made a breakthrough with my therapist. She told me, listen, this is great. You've
you know, part of this process is like opening up old wounds that have kind of scarred over. And so like you got to open it back up so you can heal it properly. But don't forget, that means it's going to be sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and like it, when you've got a sensitive wound, even like a slight touch might really hurt and you might have a really big reaction to it. So just be careful. Yeah. And I remember thinking like, I've got this, Caroline.
Right.
Okay. Like I'm
That's
good.
Great for other people.
I think I got it. That's great for other people. Mm-hmm. Yes. And that Thanksgiving, man, I had a blow up for sure. And it's not like I think it wasn't worth confronting people about, but it was a blow up, you know, yeah. Probably not the best way to introduce, like, I've been going to therapy and I've got some things I want to talk about,
yes.
You know, it just makes me wish I could have come at it with that intense, I love you. And
mm-hmm.
there are things that, you know, that like, because of my desire to strengthen my connection to you, I want out.
Yeah.
I want to talk about, I want to, you know, have it out there.
As a father, I hope that I am cultivating the relationship where I allow my son, for whenever this inevitably happens,
yes,
to be clunky, right? Like, I don't know why I keep coming back to this, not even necessarily an age, but some, I don't know, developmental. How I want to have a little bit more grace now, right? I have some things figured out, I think.
Yeah. I think.
and I want to have a little bit more grace and discernment and awareness around that. I wanted that at 21, but how could I have that without the clunkiness that shows me what not to do or how that, you know, I spoke truth, but it didn't land. Now, was my primary motivator to speak truth? Was my primary motivator to have this person understand? Was the primary, you know, there's a whole different skill to wanting to cultivate maybe gentleness with also assertiveness or, but all that I think can only be done because of the clunky rounds that I did before that. And if I can't do that with my folks, which I think a lot of people can't, I'm not stating like, oh, you know, there's a whole lot of shoulds in this, but if I can't do that in my family unit, that's a real shame. And yeah. Probably a indicator of how low the actual trust is.
That's so. Let me make sure I'm getting this right. Like, are you? So you're saying you want to make sure that your son has the ability to be clunky with you and
yes.
to like blow up and to have that experience.
Yes, that I have the tolerance built in to go. Okay,
yeah.
The context.
Yeah,
that. He's working this out for the first time. I also don't think that means I have to eat shit like it's coming off a conveyor belt. Right?
Not at all. Yeah.
And but some of it may be my assertiveness back to that to go, that's not being said with much respect, so I'm not very receptive to it. I am still your father. And some of my paternal energy is thorny
yeah.
with, I'm not going to let you speak to me that way. Right.
Yeah.
And I would hope that the tolerance is built enough to give him the benefit of the doubt.
That's really wise, I think. I think that's a really, it's also ambitious.
It's also entirely delusional. It's not going to happen.
No, but yeah. You're right. No pain, no gain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, I learned so much from my fuck ups. I
mm-hmm.
learned so much. I hate that I carry shame about it for as long as I did or as I do. I say I hate it, but the moments where I've confronted my shame about things, the moments where I've been able to feel it shed, have been some of the most transformative experiences of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't trade them. I mean, even it's kind of like the power of the present moment, right?
Because mm-hmm.
like right now, looking back at the shitty stuff is like a flash.
Yeah.
You know, and it was awful back then and it stuck with me and it glommed onto me and it grew and it festered and it got nasty. And then like in some present moment after, I got to have the experience of shedding it or healing it or, you know, reshaping it. Mm-hmm. And
yeah,
it wouldn't have been the same without all that.
That's helpful to me. It helps that that focus on the present moment. I find myself wanting to quickly speak to. I think my current romantic relationship has taught me so much about how to be raw and jokey and sarcastic and, you know, really pretty, like, have an edge with each other still that feels important. But ultimately, underneath that, and not but, and how good it feels to tell, to demonstrate to someone else, I accept you fully. Everything yeah. that's here, yes. including sometimes you're going to be clunky and sometimes you're going to make a mistake, and to witness how, what, like, the transformative aspect of actual acceptance. And then the shadow of this is that it shows me how conditional my trust is, but it is genuine nonetheless. That allows me to trust so much more. I get to go, oh, right. Okay. So if I'm generating this here, right, I don't have to just be the Buddha on the mountaintop going, I accept you completely. I also get to be clunky. I also
yeah.
get to have shitty first drafts and, you know, trust my loved ones to give me permission to revise.
Yes.
And only in hindsight, I spent decades before this relative present moment kind of telling people, right, like, I don't fully accept you. And don't bring that clunky shit around here. That's yeah. thoroughly inconvenient to me and maybe even harmful.
Yeah.
And I don't think that that means that I have to co-sign or enable behavior that feels unhealthy or even harmful to me. But there are ways to be assertive without being aggressive. And there are ways to protect myself with boundaries versus, let me just make sure that, like, the power dynamic is always just a little bit more in my favor.
Right.
Right. You and I started with, yeah, no bits, right? Like, how do we get genuine while still, I want to hear the bit and I want to be sarcastic and I want to joust with you a little bit. Yes. I love that intellectual stimulation of the wit. And when that becomes too protective for me, I go, I'm performative rather than embodied. And yes. I'm not trusting that other person a whole lot. I'm making them the audience rather than the participant. And I want to do more of actual reciprocity rather than performance.
Yeah. I think that was a very, I guess it couldn't have happened any other way, but it was a very appropriate way for our actual friendship to start. Is this, you know, is what Connor's referencing is this time that Audrey and I met him and Lexi at Superette. And we sat down together at a table and proceeded to, like, joke our way through
for hours.
2 hours yeah. straight and laughed our asses off.
Great.
Really Absolutely. Enjoyed ourselves. And then both separately had the experience of getting in the yes. car and being like, I don't think we actually, like,
it just happened.
In. Yeah. We just
what
like,
was that?
Where is like coming out of a fog. Like, what, yeah. where am I? You know, like, what
it was a reverie for sure to come out of. Yes.
But, and it was a moment of, like, not regret, but sort of loss, you know, yeah. sort of this yeah. thought of, like, wow, we, you know, really enjoy these people, but didn't connect with them really connected in a different way.
And you know what the beautiful vulnerability about this is that my girlfriend and I are in the car going, we've made a terrible mistake and we really didn't honor them. And, you know, like, really kind of getting into
yeah. Yeah.
how could we? And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if they never want to hang out with us again. You know, we weren't full on catastrophizing, sure, but we right. definitely wanted the onus of, like, we, you know, what we actually do is we owe them an apology. Next time we saw you guys, the two of you were like, I don't know what that was. I don't know what the two of us were doing. But I'm so sorry, and how we were, you know, we had to out apologize each other
yes.
before going, oh yeah, all four of us
yeah.
did that beautifully, wonderfully, speaking of being clunky. And, like, I don't actually regret it, right? Like, what a right. beautiful lesson in both. I don't have to be serious and sincere all the time. Like, what right. a shallow two-dimensional world that would be. And I also don't have to be hiding behind a mask the entire time.
Bits.
Yeah. The bits.
Yeah, I mean, after we, like clearly out apologized you guys. I felt like a real connection, and like, you know, that power dynamic just slightly shifted in our favor, and yes, that's when I felt comfortable, you know, getting vulnerable,
being real. Yeah. That's right. And I've been pursuing it ever since. As yeah, I think this episode will make clear, we are back on even ground.
All bets. Man, I love you.
Love you too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks for inviting me.
Of course. Of course.
This is great.
Yeah. I love you and I hope you come back.
I love you, but I hope you edit this in a good way that puts me in a shining light. Yes. Yeah, I'll come back. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you. This has been wonderful, as I had no doubt it would be, but
great.
I really appreciate it. You're also, just, you know, for the record of the recording, you're one of the first people that I really sat down with and sort of laid out my excitement and idea behind this podcast.
Yes.
And, it was one of the first conversations I had where I was kicking myself for not recording it, you know, because it was such a great exploration of some of the early ideas or the early like passion behind it. And, you know, we just were like sitting there at Tacos 352 having some of the most in-depth and, you know, wonderfully philosophical conversations that, you know, you could have on this topic. And it's not like you were sitting there like, do it, go, you know, and you weren't saying the opposite either. It was just the vigor in our conversation really helped me have the momentum to say like, yeah, right, I'm going to do this. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, this is going to be great.
It felt generative. That's what I remember.
Exactly. Something right.
Percolating.
Yeah. Yes. And I came back so energized from it. And I remember telling Audrey, like, this is going to be good. Mm. This is going to be and trying to, again, wishing I'd recorded it, because I'm like, and we talked about, I think,
that one
objective beauty and art, I think, right. And we talked about, it's gone. Yep. It's gone. But I remember how it felt. That is in me. And our brains store every little detail somewhere. You know, there's like every single detail of the room and the sound and our conversation, every word of our conversation is stored in some memory that's probably been tossed into the back pile, you know, with everything else. But I think like if the result of that is not remembering the words, but instead just getting the glow still, I'm very satisfied with that. I don't need all the other stuff. Sometimes it would be great to have the words, but I'll take the glow with a lot of gratitude.
Yeah. I'm glad you feel things.
Me too.
You specifically.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, right back at you.
Great.
Great.
Can I have a ride home?
We'll see. No bits.
It's such a perfect bit to end on, though.
Thank you for joining Connor and me in this conversation. I just had a blast. I'm most certainly going to invite Connor back. This time, I'm going to be more aware of his ways of making me talk. Not that I don't appreciate the opportunity to talk, but I found myself wanting more and more of Connor talking and less of me in this episode. So rest assured, Connor will return, and this time I'll be the one making him talk. In the meantime, I hope you all find a way to follow some of Connor's wisdom, learning from our fuck-ups, allowing for your children to confront you in clunky ways, you know, making that safe space for clunkiness, and, you know, getting yourself and your friend a $7 cupcake every once in a while, just to let them know that you love them and. Thanks again for being here, and thanks again to our sponsor, Crooked Path Forge. Please go to crookedpathforge.org, use promo code FINDAHAMMER to get 10% off any of the blades, axes, various metalworks, or 10% off of one of the many workshops that Jordan Borstelman, head blacksmith and founder of Crooked Path Forge, offers on a regular basis. They're wonderful workshops. I've sung their praises many times before. Hopefully by now you're convinced. Check it out for yourself. Convince yourself. Don't take my word for it. So that's crookedpathforge.org, promo code find a hammer. I tell you what, folks, the song you're listening to right now is one of Connor Mitchell's original songs. This is off an album he made during quarantine times. I have had such a great time listening to this stuff. It's just been a blast. I highly recommend you go to Bandcamp and look up his project, Lathe of Tongues. I'll say it again, Lathe of Tongues. This song in particular is called Rubber Ice Cubes in My Drink. I'm going to play another song for you after this, and that song is called Cowboys on Popcorn. And these songs are just a lot of fun to listen to, and as a matter of fact, I put one of these songs on the other night during my D&D game with my friends, and it just made the mood for me, at least. You know, I just really had a blast with listening to this while we were being creative and imagining and role playing and things like that. It was really great. So once again, this song is Rubber Ice Cubes in My Drink. This song coming up is called Cowboys on Popcorn. Once again, this is Connor Mitchell with his Lathe of Tongues project. Listen to some of these album titles too, okay? So this song is on an album called More Janky Beats to Anger Your DJ Uncle. And then the next song is on an album called Non-Quantized Termite Beats, Clogged Dad's Gasket Musket. I love it. All right. Here is Cowboys on Popcorn. Thank you for finding your way here. I'll talk to you next week with our guests, Katie Levy and Mike McVicker. It's a wonderful conversation. You're going to love it.
hitchhiking down to California with this old friend of mine, this girl, and he was sleeping on family vehicle park with a park. Mm-hmm.